We've been to all four corners of Britain in our quest to interview the great and good of entertainment. Comics, actors, writers, politicians, singers, dancers and choreographers. It doesn't matter who they are. They've all given me their own take on the world they live in and have, in their own way, helped to define what makes Britain great. So join me and my assistants as we get another insight into the marvellous and enigmatic world of showbiz here on Beyond the Title.
Writer, actress and comedian Emma Kennedy burst onto the comedy landscape as a writer for the light-hearted lunchtime Channel 4 entertainment show Late Lunch, presented by fellow comedians Mel and Sue. In 2000, Kennedy presented the last series of The Real Holiday Show on Channel 4 before securing the role as entertainment reviewer on Channel 5's Terry and Gabby show in 2003. Making appearances in TV comedies Goodness Gracious Me, This Morning with Richard Not Judy and People Like Us, Emma has become one of the most prolific supporting actors in comedy. Yet perhaps her greatest personal achievement remains claiming victory in BBC One's Celebrity MasterChef in 2012. As a writer, Kennedy has penned a repertoire of funny, warm and life-affirming novels and created the BBC One crime drama The Killing. I caught up with a creative polymath to talk legends, laughter and the secret to a successful whodunit. Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Emma Kennedy.
So, firstly, on researching your career, it's amazing how many different areas that your career has pulled you into. So when talking to people, how do you describe yourself?
Well, it's sort of shifted over the years. Obviously, I have at various times been a lawyer. And then I was an actor. But now I would describe myself as an author and screenwriter. Is where I'm at currently. But I'm a great believer in changing what you do every 10 years to keep it fresh.
Yeah. Good idea. So the Edinburgh Festival is a popular rite of passage in terms of providing a route into comedy. How did it give you a stepping stone to where you wanted to be at that point in your career?
Well, the first time I did Edinburgh Festival was, I think, back in 1987 when I was at university. And I have a vivid memory of being told that we were going to Edinburgh Festival. And at that time, I was in a comedy troupe. I think that's the right word for us. We were a troupe called the Seven Raymonds, with and two of the other people in it were Richard Herring and Stuart Lee. And we'd been sort of doing bits and bobs at university, and we'd sort of become quite culty, and people really liked us, but we weren't the official review from the university that year. So we were like the naughty sidebar. We were like the ITV2. That's what we were. And I remember vividly being told that we were going to go to Edinburgh Festival and just thinking that this was the greatest moment of my life to date. And my mother, I mean, bear in mind, nobody in my family had ever had anything to do with the creative arts or performing or doing anything. And my mother genuinely believed that because I was going to play to four people, if we were lucky, in a massive venue that we had no chance of filling at 12 o'clock on a daily basis. And this is midday, not midnight, where we probably would have got more people. That was it. I'd made it. This was it. It was going to be fame and fortune from here on. I had made it because I was going to Edinburgh Festival. And of course, now looking back at that, and you'll know this, Josh, is that looking back at that, you just think that's the most naive thing I'd ever, but it sort of encapsulates my career in a nutshell, really, that it's sort of entirely based on utterly misplaced optimism. But yeah, I loved doing Edinburgh. I've always loved doing Edinburgh. I haven't done it in a very long time. And I sort of, and I do miss it, although every single time I've done Edinburgh, I've come away with some sort of dreadful medieval illness that sort of requires really heavy duty antibiotics. But I've always loved it. I think it's a really important thing to do if you're starting out simply because you meet your peers and you will begin friendships there that will last you a lifetime. And it's worth it just for that, really. But you will have a blast. You will have terrible moments. You will not understand why anyone is coming to see your show, because I think the average Edinburgh show gets 4 people. So if you're doing better than that, you're doing really well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Josh said he's never been, but we would really like to go, so probably put it on the bucket list.
Oh, you should. Have you been up to visit, Josh? If not to perform? No. Oh no. Gosh, you must really. I can't recommend it enough. It is the most wonderful, wonderful atmosphere, and it's. I've seen things up there that are still seared into my brain. I always remember Stuart Lee running. And that might astonish you just itself, Stuart Lee running, but he was running towards me across the Pleasance courtyard, and he just sort of grabbed my forearm and said, "You have got to go and see this production that's been done by a Brazilian drama group, and they're doing the Marquis de Sade, and the last show is on like in about half an hour, and you've got to go." Yeah. And so I ran. From the Pleasance to the venue, and I got the last seat available, and it was unfortunately on the front row. And I say unfortunately for a reason, because the lights went down and sort of various sort of spotlights started going off, and every single member of the cast was masturbating, and then it went dark again, and then a naked man who was painted white and he was bald, came sort of hopping out like a lizard. like a lizard. Yeah, it was like a lizard. And he hopped towards me and turned around and bent over and parted his buttocks and farted. That was the first 5 minutes. Unbelievable. It was unbelievable. Someone did a poo on stage. It was breathtaking.
Wow.
But Edinburgh is the place where you can only see this stuff. It's like, it's just a wonderful melting pot of madness. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. You should definitely, definitely go, Josh.
So Josh has asked, was it here that you met Mel and Sue?
Yes.
And what do you think it was about their rapport and chemistry which made you realise that they had such promise?
Well, my first encounter with Mel was sitting on the floor in an Edinburgh flat, and she was wearing pink dungarees, and it was at a party, and I found myself sitting next to her, and we just got on immediately. Mm. So, like, Mel is one of those people who. She hasn't got a single bad bone in her, and she's really upbeat and really positive, and I think that's such an attractive quality, and she draws people to her. And and Sue is this sort of super, she's probably one of the most intelligent people I've ever met, Sue Perkins. And so that combination of, you know, they just bounced them, they had this glorious energy to them. And also at that time, nobody was doing that. That the previously the only female double act had been French and Saunders, and there hadn't been anyone since then. And there was just something about them that was incredibly engaging and charming. And I think those two things. Are a winning combination if you're moving forward and want to be, you know, have a TV career. But at that point, you know, nobody thought that they were going to be having a TV career. But I remember I was in an incredible flat share after the Edinburgh where I'd met them with Sue and Nicola Walker and Sarah Phelps, who now writes all the Agatha Christie adaptations at Christmas. And Easter, And at that point, all three of them were completely unemployed. And I was still a lawyer. So I had been taking them food in a plastic bag. I would buy extra food for them when I went to Sainsbury's, and then I would casually leave it at their house when I went to see them. But that sort of shifted, and then I moved in with all the three of them. But there was a phone call came, and from someone claiming to be Jennifer Saunders, and Sarah Phelps told her to fuck off and put the phone down because she thought it was someone joking. And then Jennifer Saunders rang back again, went, "No, it really is Jennifer Saunders. It really is Jennifer Saunders." And she wanted Mel and Sue to go and work on French and Saunders. So that they were sort of the first leg up for Mel and Sue, really. And then obviously Light Lunch and Late Lunch happened. But they can just do it. They've just got it. They just get it and they've got it. Yeah. And it's something that I think you can't learn. You're either charming or you're not. And they've got that in spades. So I think it was pretty old. It's like when you meet someone and you remember them. I suppose that's the thing, is that when you meet someone and you think, gosh, I'm not going to forget you. And I had it again when I met James Corden.
Yeah.
And I had that exact same feeling, like, yeah, I'm not going to forget you. And Rob Brydon, I'm not going to forget you. I mean, I've met all these people before they were actually fair. And the League of Gentlemen at Edinburgh, met the League of Gentlemen before anyone knew who they were. So it's like, I think you always know when you're meeting someone who's got something a little bit special about them, and they do.
Yeah. So you mentioned there, you secured a writing role on the light-hearted Channel 4 daytime show Late Lunch.
Yes.
In an era sort of before the Loose Women's and Today with Des and Mel, and then more recently Steph's Packed Lunch, how did you perfect the balance between that sort of adult entertainment and the more conservative principles of daytime TV?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure we ever took a blind bit of notice of the conservative... the conservative notions of daytime TV. I mean, we got away with murder, really, on that show. Absolute murder. We were openly slightly rude to guests. And I think on that show, they were just doing things that made them laugh. And I think that's the key to all great shows, is if you think about Ant and Dec, they are a perfect example of this, is that they are clearly amusing themselves. And I always think that, especially if you're involved in comedy, is you can't sit and think, okay, which audience am I trying to please here with whatever I'm doing? You just have to please yourself. And then people will either go along with you on that journey, or, you know, or what you do isn't their cup of tea. That's fine. It might be someone else's cup of tea. But I think that has to be the golden rule, that you don't think about who you are doing it for. You're doing it for them. You're doing it for Mel and Sue. You're doing it for what makes the team laugh and what you enjoy doing, and then you'll be successful. But one of my fondest memories of doing Mel and Sue was, of course, I had to share not a desk. I had to share a chair. Literally, we shared a physical chair with Georgia Pritchett, who has gone on to enormous success. She writes Succession and Veep. She went off to America, but she's had enormous success as a writer. But we literally shared a chair. We were the only girls, and they only gave us one chair between us. That's how we wrote the songs and the sketches, half sitting on each other's lap.
I
Josh, is he right in thinking that Dermot O'Leary was a researcher?
Yes, he was a researcher, and then he was he was the warm up man on Light Lunch. Yes, and again, that was somebody who was very charming, was clearly going to go places, but he was lovely. He was really, really lovely guy. And I'm so pleased for him that he's done as well as he has. But yeah, he was the researcher. He used to come and bring all the photos of Mel and Sue that they had to sign for fans. and they would sit signing them with him. But he was adorable, loved him, still love him.
In 2003, then you appeared as an entertainment reviewer on Channel 5's The Terry and Gabby Show.
Yes.
What's the hardest thing about doing live TV? And what are your memories of the late, great Terry Wogan?
Oh, well, number one, not swearing, for a start. honestly, I once got into terrible trouble on Loose Women. I did an appearance on Loose Women and I was telling a story about my book, I Left My Tent in San Francisco. And I used the word hand job, not thinking for a moment that that was a forbidden word. It absolutely was a forbidden word. And so it's like there is something just terrifying about the thought that you're going to say something unconscionably rude, inadvertently, you know. But you really cannot say a single thing. So that's number one. And then number two. I'm put in mind specifically, not so much of the Terry and Gabby show, but of when I did This Morning with Richard, Not Judy, because that was live. And that was absolutely terrifying because obviously you had lines that you had to learn. We were actually acting live rather than just doing reviews. And how I kept the contents of my bowel inside me for that, to this day I still do not know. But the Terry and Gabby thing was slightly more different because it was. Obviously, you're just coming on and you're being yourself, so you haven't got the pressure of remembering lines and stuff like that. But Terry was, he was a very gracious man and he was a very generous man. And it was a real honour, actually, to have been able to work with him. And whenever my mum and dad came in, he was always absolutely charming to them. But he was lovely. He was a lovely, lovely guy. Really lovely guy.
Great. As an actor, you made appearances in some of the biggest comedies from the post-millennium era. What do you think it was about that period which spawned so many shows which have stood the test of time?
Well, the BBC still had a proper budget for comedy, so that's number one.
Yeah.
And I think... Well, things like People Like Us, I think, wouldn't get made today. It was that I think there was a lot of shows I was in that had never been done before. So People Like Us, which was the sort of first comedy docudrama, you get all of it. That show in and of itself spawned so many copycat things. Like you wouldn't have Staff Makes Flats now without having had People Like Us, but People Like Us was the first one to do it, and it was written by John Morton, and that is easily, I think, the best thing I've ever been in. It was amazing to be in that. And then Smoking Room, of course, that was the first comedy that was done in. It was shot in real time, so the half hour of the episode was the half hour of their lives, and that had never been done before. But again, like, I don't think either of those shows would get made now, because I think there's less risk taking going on for various reasons, but mostly budgetary reasons. But also that there was sort of a slight fly by your pants feel. I mean, especially I'm thinking of again This Morning with Richard, Not Judy. I can't believe we got away with what we were allowed to do on a Sunday morning. It was extraordinary. But again, I think the commissioner sort of had a hands-off approach to it, and that was very much what it used to be like, that commissioners would just commission it and then they would let the creative people get on with what they wanted to do. But now it's a bit more sort of by committee.
Yeah.
Which I think knocks the life out of some things. They get it right sometimes, but there's so little comedy now on television. I mean, I'm struggling to think of one that's currently on BBC One that isn't a panel show. There's Not Going Out and there's Mrs. Brown Boys, which I think are the only two studio sitcoms that are currently being made. I don't think there's any studio sitcoms being made anymore. And I think of things that are on Channel 4 and BBC Two, but there's very little going on.
Josh, did you think that's as well because BBC don't have the studio space anymore?
Yeah, quite possibly, but it's just a different thing now. It's a weird sort of catch 22 is that the comedies that get the most viewers are studio sitcoms.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. You know, if you get a studio sitcom right, that's the show that's going to be pulling in 5 million plus. But the other thing is people don't want to don't want to do studio sitcoms because they're a bit uncool, and they really need to be led by big writer performers, so probably stand up. So that's why Lee Mack is perfect for studio sitcoms, mm-hmm. as is Brendan O'Carroll. But people. It's a really difficult thing to get right, and not many people can do it, to be honest.
No.
But I think also a lot of the youngsters, I like to call them, coming up, you know, they're just cool. And when you're cool and you want to do single camera, you know, no laughter track, all of that.
Yeah.
So I think that's where most people are going.
Hmm.
I don't see anyone saying, "Oh, I want to write a studio sitcom."
I just have a
Josh, I didn't know about you, but as soon as he hears a laughter track, he thinks, "Oh, it's a bit outdated now."
Yeah. I mean, it does feel that. Yeah, a laughter track does feel dated, and I think that's the thing. But I mean, a lot of people will show they'll film their whatever they're making, and then they will play it in front of a live audience, and that's when and they record the laughter track that way. But there is still something still, you know, I suppose for want of a better word, people think it's uncool.
Mm.
And no one wants one. Whereas when we used to have good old sketch shows, do you remember sketch shows? I used to love sketch shows. French and Saunders, Armstrong and Miller. We don't have any sketch shows anymore on TV. It's just panel shows. Panel shows and talk shows. That's it. That's where sort of the thrust of comedy is going these days. Or it's single camera comedies with no laugh track. But yeah.
Hmm. As a writer, you've created a repertoire of funny and life-affirming novels. In your opinion, how are comedy and tragedy closely related?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I mean, I suppose if you think about times when you've laughed so hard you've cried, or cried so hard you started laughing, it's that thing, isn't it? It's taking someone to the edge of an emotion, and on the wheel of happy and sad, you know, it does go in a circular motion. But it's something I've been properly sort of exploring in my latest book that's out, which is about my mum. And a lot of that is sort of tragicomic. I mean, like the moment she died, perfect example. She died, and that we were all in the room with her, and it was my job to make sure she actually was dead. I mean, what a responsibility. And I had to put my fingers on her arm to check for a pulse. So everyone around me is now crying. I've remembered, sort of as we're all weeping, that it's my job to put my fingers on her wrist to find a pulse. And I found a pulse. So I then had to turn to the room and go, wait, no, she's not dead. And it's that sort of thing where my mother would have absolutely loved it. She would have been laughing her socks off. It was like the perfect exit for her. So is she dead or not? But anyway, she was dead. She was dead. But it's like the stories I've had a couple of friends who've said when they've gone to scatter the ashes of a parent or something that they haven't really known how to do it, and it's all blown in their face. It's a very fine line between sad and funny.
Yeah. In 2020, you penned your first drama, The Killing, which aired on BBC One. How does writing for television alter the way you think about telling a story?
Well, I didn't write The Killing. I would have loved to have written The Killing. I wrote The Killing Handbook, which was a book about The Killing. But The Killing is the greatest TV drama that there has ever been on television. So if you've never watched
Should we just pretend that you did write that then?
And don't watch the American remake. You need to watch the Danish original, which is called Forbrydelsen. And I know it's pronounced that way because I got Sophie Grubble, who is the star of it, to teach me how to say it for boodles. But I have written drama, and I can tell you right now that it is vastly easier than writing comedy. The first time I wrote a drama script, it was like I was almost furious. I was almost on the cusp of fury because I couldn't believe how much easier it is to do than writing a comedy script, because you're just telling a story rather than telling a story and adding jokes at the same time. So there's no doubt in my mind that writing comedy is 1,000% harder than writing drama, and I will die on that hill.
I agree.
Josh said he agrees.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, honestly, this is the thing that's slightly infuriating. When it comes around to award season and BAFTAs and Oscars and all of these things, it's always the dramas that get all the praise heaped upon them. Excuse me, all you've had to do is tell a story. Try telling the story and making it funny.
Yeah.
And all that. And this is another bugbear of mine that when you get to vote for, I am a BAFTA voter. And every single time I'm asked to pick people for supporting actor and supporting actress from the list that you are provided with, there is never, ever an opportunity to vote for anyone that's in a comedy for supporting actor or actress, as if acting in a comedy doesn't count. It drives me round the bend.
Yeah.
And I think it's the hardest thing to do. And it's something that you cannot be taught. You cannot be taught how to be funny. You can't do it. You've either got funny bones or you haven't.
Josh, you're just going to tell you something. It's not about your career, but it is relevant.
So yeah, go on.
Bear with. Josh did script writing at university for 3 years, and guess how many lectures they had on comedy?
Oh, none.
One. So
it's like an art form that doesn't exist, isn't it, in the minds of many people. Extraordinary. And it's like everybody loves laughing. Who sits back and goes, oh, I hate laughing? No one.
What a chore.
What a bore.
Justin, the thing is with comedy as well, it's so easily relatable. Like, not everyone can relate to the dramas that are on TV, especially.
Yeah.
Some of the, you know.
Yes.
BBC ones are a little.
Yes, but I completely agree. Agree.
So, looking back at your career, what's your proudest achievement?
Oh, blimey. Oh, I actually have to think quite hard about this. My proudest moment. Do you know what? I think, wait, my proudest. Hang on, because helping organise the largest kazoo orchestra in the world has got to be up there. That's got to be up there. Yeah.
What was that one?
Got to be up there. That was for Comic Relief. Yeah, I worked out the other day. I've collectively helped raise about £5 million for Comic Relief. That's not bad, is it?
Good.
So in terms of achievements, that's pretty good. Mm. But in terms of a personal achievement, I suppose the Tent, the Bucket and Me becoming a bestseller. That was pretty awesome. And I didn't expect that at all. So that was great. But I'm really proud of the book I've just... I think the book I've just written is the best book I've ever written, which is Letters from Brenda. And I'm personally very proud of that because obviously, because of its subject matter, it was deeply, deeply personal. Writing for Danger Mouse was pretty cool. That was cool. And for Paddington, that was cool. Mm. Yeah, but it's weird, isn't it? I suppose because I've been in the game for so long that there's no one sort of standout moment that is sort of crying out to me. I think the project I'm most proudest of being involved in, because I think it was excellent, was a radio series called The Sunday Format. And that was exceptional. That was a really exceptional project. So let's say The Sunday Format.
Okay. What was that?
Are you aware of John Holmes's show, The Skewer, that's on now?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, it was it was that, but like 20 years ago. And it was the way it was done was you were supposed to be, I'm explaining this badly, but it the Sunday format was a pretend Sunday supplement, a pretend right. newspaper, and it sort of chopped and changed through. It gave you the feeling that you were reading, flicking through a Sunday supplement paper. So, so it was all different characters, but it was produced in such a way that you sort of sometimes didn't get to the end of sketches, and it was very clever and very brilliant and very, very, very funny.
Oh, darling, I should say,
Josh, I don't know if you should say this, but John Holmes is someone else who he thought he was interviewing, but turned out he wasn't.
Oh, that's hilarious. Who were you interviewing?
Gary Lineker's agent.
Gary Lineker's agent.
John Holmes.
Oh, that's hilarious.
These are people that name share and then put themselves on the handbook or out of agents.
That's so funny.
Yeah. So, lastly, what's next for Emma Kennedy?
Okay, so I have co-written a drama, which we are. It's three quarters green lit, which is sort of the most tantalising place you can be. So there's that which is almost happening. So there's that. I'm working on a new book, or what I hope will be a new book. I'm trying to get an animated series away at the moment. So those are the three main things that I'm currently concentrating on.
Yeah, when all those things have happened, we'll have to come back and talk about them.
I'd be very happy to.
Yeah, lovely. Well, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Really appreciate it.
Lovely to meet you both.
Yeah, lovely to meet you.
Thank you to our guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title interview. If you liked this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else that takes your fancy? Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews and to see more information about me and what I do. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time.